Welcome to this week's episode of Khaki Monarchy. Today, we are joined by Mike Cole to talk about his book, The Bronze Sly.
I was just going to live. I was out in the rain yesterday and I've got a bit of a sore throat today. I've got that As soon as it stops,
everyone's run down in England.
Everyone gets cold.
we've got rain and hot here in New Orleans, Louisiana. So.
Oh, nice. Oh, I was going to say, where are you?
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah, I used to be a New York guy, and I'm splitting time now between there and New Orleans, and I'm probably wind up relocating here. It's one of the things about the U.S., sort of every biome in the world, right? You want desert, we've got desert. You want the swamp, we've got the swamp. Yeah, we've got everything.
Definitely. Well, it sounds great.
That's nice. Variety.
And you guys are in London, or?
Well, oh, yeah, I'm in London. Lives a bit further north.
Whereabouts, Libby?
Norfolk, on the coast.
Sure.
So yeah. The bump.
Yep. You know, I know it went pretty well. I'll probably be over in the spring. I need to go to around Bath, I'll to Devizes and Roundway Down and Lansdowne around there in the, I guess, the West Midlands, you would call it.
Yeah. I love
that. Is that for a future project? Is that for your next book?
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah. I'm sort of my goal for career. I don't know if you're familiar with the historian Tom Holland, but obviously, like, I've made my name in the ancient world, but what I love about his career is he has such range, right? He writes about Islam, he writes about the late dark ages in England, he writes about the ancient world. So I want to do my next project.
I've just got Dominion, my new addition to my bookshelf is Dominion. Oh,
I've awesome. Got Rubicon on my next to read.
I mean, he's just such an incredible writer. I'm in awe of him. But I want to do your Wars of the Three Kingdoms. The 100 years in the 1600s is just this period of military history. Nobody knows anything about it. I mean, most English people don't know anything about it. And so Sir Arthur Haselrig, and it's funny, there's still a Haselrig seat in Knowsley in Leicestershire. He's still, like, his descendant is still there. He had the last armored cavalry regiment in history, and it was destroyed at Roundway Down. And this is in 1643, and no one's written a book about him. The steel lobsters, the London lobsters, they call them. So I've sort of gotten into his life, and he has a really cool sort of traumatic storyline, which I think leads to him deciding to put this obsolete armor on his troopers. And I really want to tell that story. And it's Knights with Guns, which is such a cool topic. So yeah, so I'm excited. Yeah. I mean, it's scary because with the ancient world, you know, you have a real paucity of sources. So it's very easy to be a completist. But when you're dealing with the English Civil War, it's the printing press, right? I could never get through everything that there is to. And also, you know, the people in England who are into your Civil War, they're really into it. So there will be people looking, if we're an American to write on this topic, there are going to be people looking to knife me for doing that. So I better not mess it up, you know?
No, you won't. You won't.
Thank you. Right.
Faith in you. Right. Thanks. Well, no, should we? Yeah.
Let's talk about the Bronze Sly, because
definitely. Let's jump in.
Lovely book. Good, I love the front cover. I love the cover artwork as well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, actually, one funny thing about the cover is those two weapons on the cover, they're in the collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, and they're labeled as Greek Machaira, which is why Osprey chose them as the cover, but they're actually Iberian Falcata. So they're not correct. It's fine. They're certainly the same shape as Greek Machaira of the equivalent. But real nerds of the period have been giving me a hard time. Right.
Like, see, wherever you go, they get their knives.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Should we jump in then? Let's talk about the book.
Please.
We ask all of our authors who come on to do this question. Can you possibly summarize your book in 30 seconds?
Yes, it is a leftist revisionist history of leftist revisionist military history of Sparta. Done.
I like that. Amazing. What, not even 5 seconds. Boom, let's go. Let's dive in then.
All right. Everybody's so funny. People use the term revisionist history like it's a bad word. But the truth is, all history is revisionist history. I think the one thing that really, and I don't want to get too political. I make no bones that it's funny, in spite of being a war fighter and a cop, and a firefighter, I'm a definite committed leftist. I make no bones about it, and a social justice advocate. But I also, you know, look, one thing I don't like about 2021 is we just are awful to each other. And I'm just not willing to do that. You know, if we're going to bring the world along, we've got to find a way to have discourse. So I don't, but one thing I did really find disturbing is that since 2016, when Bojo got elected over on your side of the pond and we got Trump here, there really has been a global resurgence, not just in normal right-wing politics, but in really extreme right-wing politics, you know?
Yeah.
You guys went through UKIP, and of course you have the Spartans over there, that the MPs that call themselves the Spartans, which is very relevant. And this kind of really extreme, right. And this kind of really extreme political rhetoric has used the Spartans, the ancient Spartans, as a symbol, always. And it really went into overdrive. The idea of the Spartans is history's greatest warriors, as these badasses that never surrender, like that's been around since, frankly, 480 BC, but it has gone over to overdrive in a really serious way, I'd say, in the past 4 or 5 years. And a professor from the University of Iowa named Sarah Bond wrote an amazing piece in a sadly now defunct journal called Eidolon, which I highly recommend people look it up. It's free online, where she kind of goes through the overall history of Sparta and is saying, you know, look, our view of the Spartans as these self-sacrificing, unbribable, total badasses is just wrong. And has been misused by some really disturbing movements like the Nazis. And I read that piece and thought, oh, wow, you know, has anybody done this from a strictly military perspective? Yeah. Just gone through, because if the argument is that the Spartans are the greatest badasses, right? They never lost, they never surrendered. Well, we should be able to see that in the record, right? Like we have, by the way, I apologize. I realize like I look like I'm speaking to you from heaven. I have the
embrace the glow, embrace the glow.
Yeah, I'll take it. This is New Orleans. We should be able to go through Polybius and Xenophon and Herodotus and Thucydides and keep score, right? We have sources we can check against each other. Yeah. And all I did, it's not complicated. It's not even particularly smart. All I did was make a scorecard, and it's in the center of the book. And at a glance, I let readers see, when did they win? When did they lose? When did they tie? When did they run? When did they surrender? When did a king die? And I tried to be not exhaustive, you can't, but be comprehensive. So, you know, naval battles and battles on bad ground and battles on good ground and sieges, and they were surprised and they surprised the enemy, and throughout their entire roughly thousand years of military history, and paint that picture. And what I hope that would do is, of course, take that myth away from the far right, so that neo-Nazis and UKIP, if any of your listeners are UKIP members, please don't be offended. But I wanted to take that symbol so that when British MPs say, "Where are the Spartans?" I could be like, "Are you sure you want the Spartans?" Yeah. You know,
hang on.
You know, here's who the Spartans really were. But one thing I do want to say is, of course, what happens is I'm a leftist, but I'm also uncomfortable with the far left, you know, just cancel culture discourse that we have here in the United States and Britain. And what I don't want is for the book to also be used by the far left as a bludgeon to beat up people on the right. I'm certainly fine saying to people on the right, hey, you're wrong about this.
Yeah.
But what I always wanted that to be done is in a respectful way.
Completely.
And because I really want a change in national, global discourse, especially on social media, which I'm ashamed to admit I certainly was not in the early days of my career part of the solution. I was part of the problem. But this is a long-winded way.
I think we all learn why I wrote on social media.
It's learning.
Like you said, I think politics can be so divisive and so tribal at times, and so people don't take any nuance out of it. So it's really refreshing to hear your perspective in
completely
through an ancient, through a military perspective.
Yeah.
What interests us. But I wish people would take more of that view when looking at far left, far right. I mean, say what you will about centrism, but we do need to find some common ground in some way. And it's nice that this kind of literature can help towards this and help disband those myths. Because as you say, a lot of people don't realise where the Nazis were getting their symbols from, where UKIP mm-hmm. were taking their symbols from.
Yeah.
It's really, really interesting. And I'm glad that we've got you on here to kind of show some
thanks.
Finding balance, isn't it? It's like bringing equilibrium to it all.
Right. And the thing is, for me, I'm either with the police or I'm in the military or now I'm with a fire brigade, and in the United States that's the right of the right, you know. And these are people who I have to rely on them to save my life, and I have to save their lives at risk of my own. And also I see these people, right, who say some of them saying these incredibly problematic things which would get them canceled on Twitter immediately, but what are they doing? They're running into a burning building with no concern for who's inside. They're not checking their political affiliation or their race or their gender. They're running into that burning building because that's their job. They're 100%. Putting on gear, firefighting gear, famously, at least in the United States, it gives you cancer, contaminated with PFAS, and they know it. We know it, and we put it on anyway. And they're, what about that, right? You know, and so like I'm just not willing to, of course, as horrified as I am by a lot of the political terms, and as much as I want to flip a table, you have to do the hard work of having a conversation. 100%. You have to sit down with this person you disagree and talk to them, you know. So
So what, going like, just going back into that, the kind of the Spartan, in the context of Spartan military history, I guess, what have you, can you give a bit more context to our listeners just about how the Spartans fought, what the big battle, any key details you want to give a kind of about the period?
So
in this context,
thanks for the question. This is the biggest point I want to make. The myth that is perpetuated primarily by the film 300, Zack Snyder film in 2006, and then by the comic 300 of the same name in 1998 by Frank Miller, and also just in our regular discourse, the very word Spartan means not liking luxury. It is false. It is false from soup to nuts. They were not super warriors. They were good warriors in some ways and bad warriors in others, and the book details it, but they were human beings first and foremost. And that's what I want people to see. The idea that they were particularly militaristic is itself false. The reality is that Spartan society, the best thing I can compare it to is medieval knighthood, is that you have a very, very small, tiny percentage of the population, the homoioi, the peers, who are the Spartan citizens, full citizens, who are enfranchised at the top. And they have a slave caste known as the Helots that do all their domestic and agricultural labor. There are second-class citizens called the perioikoi. These are means the people who live around Sparta. They are Spartans, but they're not citizens with political rights. And they do the crafting and the building, they're artisans. And this tiny little minority at the top live in apartheid luxury, right? They don't have to work. And what do? They don't train for war. We don't have any evidence that they're training for war. We have evidence they're doing sports. We have evidence that they're engaging in some physical training. We have some evidence that they are more disciplined and organized than other Greeks, but only by the standards, the incredibly amateur standards of Greek warfare. You have to remember that there were no professional armies in ancient Greece, right? Most people were farmers, or you have your job, you make pots, you tan leather, whatever it is you do. And then, you know, once a year, a couple times a year, they ring the bell. You grab this old rusty spear that your granddad left you, you know, out of the shed, and you show up at the town square, and you all form into this phalanx, which is this really simple formation where you're all standing shoulder to shoulder with your shields overlocking and your spin. You go that way and you stab the guy in front of you. And it's so easy that even you, a full-time farmer, can't mess it up, right? When you look at that as the standard of Greek warfare, it's easy to be good compared to that, right? And if you don't have to work, but what are they doing? They're not training for war. They're throwing the discus. They're throwing the javelin. They're doing foot races. They're managing their estates. They're politicking. They're riding horses and hawking and engaging in hunting. And, you know, they're probably engaging in music and art. So the life of a Spartan is the opposite of this rigorous, you know, tough guy where you have no luxury. No, it's the life of an aristocratic dandy, you know, where let me go see how my olives are growing today. Southfield, you know, the slaves, they're being so lazy. Let me go give them a pep talk, you know, that kind of thing. Now, we do have evidence that the Spartans were a more disciplined and organized fighting force, which may hint at some kind of military expertise, but it seems to be limited to their heavy infantry. What they didn't do, these are the hoplites, right? The guys in the armor with the round shields and the spears.
Right.
It seems that they never developed a native capability in cavalry and naval warfare and siege warfare. All of this was outsourced to allies or mercenaries, and that dogged them for their entire military career. So while we certainly see some military successes in terms of the Spartans, we see a lot of failures for that conservatism. And that failure to adapt. And the final thing I really want to set the table for in terms of Spartan militarism with your listeners is, the Spartan legend is sort of forged wholesale the Battle of Thermopylae in 480 BC. This is the battle that is the subject of the film 300 and the comic 300, which is really what most people think of when they think of the Spartans. And what's the myth? The myth is that 300 Spartans alone, led by their king Leonidas, knowing they would die, march out to Thermopylae to face an army of a million Persians. And even though they all died knowing that they would die, they destroyed the Persian morale and bolstered the Greek, stiffened the Greek spine, and therefore the Greeks were able to win against Toklasov. Yeah. And it is nonsense. Nonsense soups to nuts. There were not 300 Spartans, there were 1,000. There were those 1,000 Spartans were part of a force of 7,000 Greeks. And when you look at the Pass of Thermopylae, it was very easy for them to hold that ground with just 7,000 people. They had every expectation of winning. It was not a suicide mission. They were trying to starve the Persian army out by holding them in place. Leonidas was outgeneraled by a brilliant Persian high command, and they were wiped out to a man. They lost. It was a horrible defeat. And so this idea that this is a glorious suicide mission that people on the far right want to hold up as an example, it's just nonsense. It's a loser's cry. And the toxic and dangerous thing about it, maybe dangerous is too strong a word, but the toxic thing about it that I really want to highlight is Herodotus has this not helpful East versus West narrative, right? That we have these Western civilized Greeks, and we have Eastern barbarian Persians. Mm. And they're coming in, and these Greeks are going to keep them out. And it isn't true. The truth is that Greek and Persian culture were so intermarried that they might as well have been. There's a family spat, not an existential fight. And I think that's really very important.
Well, this East-West divide is such a confusing thing in history, isn't it?
Yeah.
How much crossover there is between societies, what you realize has always been borrowed from everyone, and they were always sharing ideas with each other. So it's quite ridiculous that idea is actually still sticking in this point in history.
Yes, no, you're exactly right. You are exactly right. And of course, east and west of the Hellespont, what today we call the Dardanelles, where Istanbul is. But the problem is that far-right movements, they have an anti-immigrant agenda, right? They you know, every far-right movement is especially targeting Islam. Mm. And of course, modern Persia, now Iran, is an Islamic country. So it's a very useful story for them to hold on to, right? And that's another thing I want to try to disarm. This is a family spat between two cultures that are almost the same. Mm-hmm. And it is not this glorious suicide, and it was just a terrible defeat.
You're so passionate about this, you know, you can clearly tell. I think you're getting your message across, and it's important because, you know, you've got your mission, and it's so lovely to see someone who really is dedicated to like a historical cause in a way. So I'd love to know, you know, you touch upon the myths and all of this stuff, but what got you into this particular period of history? Was it 300?
Oh, no. Well, I mean, so here's the thing is, it's so interesting. I, as a military and police guy, look, I came out of the conservative movement in the United States. I was a right winger here, and it was going to, I'm not proud of it, but I'm also not going to lie about it. It was actually going to Iraq three times that made me a leftist, because I realized, oh my God, you know, this is a really bad, this is the consequences of political decisions. I wish I could say more of us in this community have had that kind of awakening, but I'll take my own turnaround. So that definitely put me on the political road that I'm on. But then I'm an old school nerd. Like I don't have a lot of friends. I'm into nerd stuff, and I played war games. And I was wargaming battles between the Roman legion and the Hellenistic phalanx. So this is the later evolution of the hoplite phalanx with two-handed pikes instead of one-handed spears. And I went to go find a book on these battles, and there wasn't one. And I said, oh, well, I'll write it. And I had a background then as a science fiction and fantasy novelist. I had several books out. And I went to my agent and said, I'm gonna write this history book on the legion versus the phalanx. And my agent said, well, you don't have a PhD and no background in history, you can't do it. And if you know me, go ahead, tell me what I can't do. I was like, oh, really? And I went and I taught myself Greek and I taught myself Latin, and I researched this book and I wrote it and I sold it and it got published and it did well. And I was like, all right, now I'm an historian, you know, like now I have the chops to do this. So when Osprey came in, you know, someone came to New York and sat down and had dinner with me and said, what do you want to do next? You know, if you're lucky in this business, if a book does well, you get carte blanche to do what you want to do next. And I had just finished reading that Sarah Bond piece that I mentioned to you before. And I was like, you know, it would be really cool. And I was just spitballing. It would be really cool to sit down and go through this from a military perspective. And he was like, that sounds controversial. That sounds good. Let's go with it. So it really was, look, I say this on every interview, I really have Sarah Bond to thank for that initial article, like sparking this idea. And of course, once I got into it, it was right in the heart of the Trumpist rise in the United States. So it actually, it felt good because, look, when the president of the United States is someone you disagree with really strongly, and his movement and his party is gaining so much power, and I know this was happening with Bojo's election in Britain, you feel so helpless.
Yeah.
You know, feel like there's, what are you going to do? You know, this is a democratic process. You know, the people have spoken, you know, there's nothing. Yeah. So what do you do with that helplessness? You donate to your party that you support, you campaign for candidates you support, you, and you write a book, you know, so it really helped me. I guess I have Donald Trump and Boris Johnson to thank for this book.
That's a first.
Yeah, I'm thinking, well, yes. We don't often credit them on this show, but we'll say for that reason.
You know, Boris Johnson he's a real classicist and wrote a very good book on Rome. He's a real Latin and a real class. It's hard to reconcile, but it's true.
So you write about, I think, something that is very closely linked to the politics we've been talking about, is this idea of militarism being used as a means of control over a society.
Sure.
You talk about that in The Bronze Lie. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that and about how militarism was, about how militarism presented itself essentially in Spartan society?
Sure. And this is the thing I think that's tough for us to accept in 2021, is that we really have come a long way in terms of the role of violence in society. I know that's hard to believe in a world that's so riven by wars, and you just watch the US pull out of Afghanistan. But the truth is that the ticket to status in modern society comes through success in business, it comes through success in politics, it comes through success in entertainment. We admire artists, we admire Elon Musk, you know, we admire great politicians. And for most of human history, that was not the case. For most of human history, the gateway to wealth and status was killing, period. That was how you became a person of note in society. That's how you advanced your financial fortunes. It's how you advanced your political fortunes. You were a killer or you weren't. And of course, there were religious avenues, of course, and everyone knows the old sort of feudal salt. You have those who work, those who pray, and those who fight. But those who fight was really the role. And I think it's tough for people, you know, especially in our woke, in this particularly hyper woke period that we're in, to really reckon with that and to look back and frankly reckon with the status of women in the ancient world, the status of political minorities and ethnic minorities in the ancient world, the status of slaves, and the role that violence played. You know, we don't want to confront our own human past. And I think, in a way, though, it does fill me with hope to see it, because, look, because it's a reminder that as hard as things are in 2021, man, have we come a long way. Sparta, shockingly enough, you know, if you were going to be a woman in ancient Greece, it's just one of the most epically misogynistic cultures in the history of time. It's you know, it makes modern Saudi Arabia look like a cakewalk, the status of women in that country.
Wow.
It's in the ancient world. And Sparta was actually one of the few city-states where women had some semblance of rights. You certainly wouldn't want to be a woman anywhere in ancient Greece, but in Sparta, it was certainly better. You could inherit land, you could exercise. You know, there were certain ways you could dress and move on a company that you couldn't in other parts of ancient Greece. But even by that standard, when I look at, with all the challenges that women face in 2021, you know, we're making progress. And so, and we're also making progress in this, in male violence. As hard as it is to admit that, with all of the violence that we see, boy, are we making progress. You know, I will, and most men, I think, in our ages, will go through our lives now, never hitting anyone, never having to, you know, that's not, in fact, having legal repercussions for that. Whereas in the ancient world, there's no way for you to exist in society without it. So, it's sort of a round way answer of saying that we are making progress, and it does give me hope for the future.
Yeah. Well, no, interesting. It is. I agree with you. We are making progress. I think violence isn't as, the idea that men have to rely on violence as their entire status in society is not as entrenched. Obviously, it's very...
No.
Liv, I'm sure you feel the same at the moment. Violence in the UK, I don't know if you've been following the Sarah Everard case. It's a really, really weird period because, you know, and I appreciate your opinion on it. And yes, we have come so far in the entrenched misogyny in societies like Greek society, ancient Greek society. We've not got that. We've got, definitely got a long way to go, and it's nice to go back and go, okay, well, at least it's not that shit. Still,
we
shit,
are making progress. Yeah,
we're heading in the right direction.
Yeah,
but we had, I think it was our first episode. We had Paul Crystal on to talk about women in ancient warfare.
We did,
and that was really interesting. And other women, other people we've had on to talk about women kind of crossing the boundaries of what was expected from society, it is interesting. But those little examples that get picked out, and I wish there was more of it. And yeah, it's nice to hear.
Yeah. So there's a great essay. There's a great essay I'd love to suggest for you and your listeners by Cameron Hurley called "We Have Always Fought." One of the points she makes in the essay is we will never have a look and reliable look at women's role in ancient and medieval combat because we don't know to what extent they're raced. We don't know to what extent we have Aristotle. We know Aristotle is virulent misogynist. He's scandalized by Spartan women. He calls them thigh flashers for just nonsense. Yeah. You know, and Herodotus certainly talks about Daenerys and her beheading of the Persian king. We have these moments. He talks about Artemisia. We have these stories, but there's a kind of breathless othering to them. And because men are writing the history, and because they're certainly, we're probably never going to have as good a picture. There's a wonderful anecdote about this that I know after the Battle of Waterloo, a woman's corpse was found in the French cavalry in a French cuirassier's uniform. And no one knows how she got there, or who she was.
Wow.
And that things like that are, you wonder how many stories like that are we missing?
So many stories.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, coming back to our Spartans then.
Yes.
I'm really intrigued to hear, is there any particular battles or even a warrior that you'd like to highlight for us today? You know, there's got to be someone who is a complete badass and you're like, yeah, their story or this battle. Here we go. Spotlight is on this one moment in history.
Yeah.
The stage is yours.
So I don't want to highlight a badass. I want to highlight a human being. The problem with us talking about the Spartans is that we constantly talk about them as badasses. So I have an article that's coming out in Smithsonian Magazine this month on Brasidas, everyone has heard about, it's actually online now. If your listeners Google Mike Cole, Michael the Y, and Smithsonian, you'll find the article.
We'll post the link on our Twitter pages.
Oh, thank you. 100%. Thank you. Everyone knows about Leonidas. This is this fated commander who committed suicide, he didn't, at Thermopylae. You know, he's played by this hunky 36-year-old Gerard Butler. In reality, he was 60 years old when he died. We know almost nothing about this guy, right? The only thing we know about him is that he was a general at a battle and he lost. Was he good? Was he bad? Was he, what else? We don't know.
Ugly.
But yet, everyone has heard of him. And he's famous as this bronze statue that nobody can identify with, this ready to go to his death warrior, right? So Brasidas, no one has heard of, except maybe some people. He appears briefly in the Assassin's Creed Odyssey video game, so maybe some people know him from there. He's a fascinating character because we know a lot about him, about his life. And where Leonidas' story is so movie picturesque that I'm immediately like, this is bollocks. I'm sorry, I'm allowed to curse on your show.
You're allowed to swear, it's fine.
Oh, fine, okay. Wait, it's malarkey is on our name, come on.
Fair enough. It's just nonsense. But Brasidas' story is so human that I'm like, oh, this must be true. So the story is the Athenians, during the Peloponnesian War, where Sparta and Athens, their respective leagues, were at war, the Athenians built what's called an epiteichisma, which is like a forward operating base in territory on the coast of Messenia. And the Spartans were wild to get them out of their territory. And they had a very small outnumbered position on a beach, and it was a rocky beach and there was no place to land. And the entire Spartan fleet is there, has them completely surrounded. And Brasidas orders his triarch, his captain of his ship, to wreck his ship on the rocks and drops a gangplank and is the first down the gangplank charging into these Athenians. Well, gangplanks on triremes in the 5th century BC, they're basically wide enough for one dude to run down. And he's charging onto a beach where five or six guys can surround the other end of that gangplank, which is really brave and really stupid. And what do? They shoot him up with javelins and sling stones, and he doesn't get 2 feet. It's like the opening scene from Saving Private Ryan, if you remember that, where they're just all gunned down. Yeah. And he falls back onto the boat and his shield slips off into the sea. And if folks remember the quote from Plutarch, the Spartan mother says, come back with your shield or on it. Like losing your shield is a real dishonor. And he did. Mm. And he's defeated. They lose the battle. By the way, a bunch of Spartans surrender. Mm-hmm. Contrary to their legend that they never surrender. And he's humiliated. Now, you would expect, because this is what Herodotus tells us, that a Spartan who loses and lives commits suicide, right? He would never live with that decision, which is, of course, nonsense.
Yeah.
What does Brasidas do? He learns. He was brave. He was stupid. He ran in without thinking, and he got his ass kicked. Yeah. So we next see him, and he's marching north. So he obviously healed. He got better, and the Spartans kept him in command. And he marches north at the head of an army to attack Athenian positions in North Greece around Olynthus. And what you see here now is he wins battle after battle. Excuse me, he wins city after city after city without fighting. He doesn't fight. He uses diplomacy. He uses coercion. He uses fifth columns. He lies. He bribes. But he doesn't fight. And I don't know if anyone's saying this, but it's really clear to me that he learned. Right?
Yeah.
It's really clear to me that he's like, oh shit, yeah, ass kicked.
That was a really this bad idea, Matt.
Right. I'm gonna do things differently. And that's what makes him a hero, right? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, I don't want to hear about Leonidas. Like, you know, I always say this. I don't know if you or your listeners are fans of Lord of the Rings. I'm actually not, surprisingly, for a nerd. And one of the reasons I don't like it is that Frodo Baggins, the protagonist, there's nothing wrong with him. Frodo Baggins does nothing wrong. Like Frodo Baggins has no flaws. You know, I think this is one of the reasons why people really liked the Game of Thrones is that everybody in that TV show had something horribly wrong with them.
Yeah.
And we as human beings, we all have things horribly wrong with us. So we're able to identify with those characters. So when people want to know about Spartans, I want them to know about Brasidas because Brasidas messed up.
Yeah.
Like we all messed up. And then he learned and got better and ended on a high note. Which means we all can learn and get better and end on a high note. So that's the spotlight. And I would really encourage folks, Brasidas, Google him, read his wiki entry. He's an amazing character.
I like that. That is a great spotlight.
Thank you.
And also just very badass in his own way. Like you say,
sometimes badass in a different way.
Yeah.
100%.
Well, that was definitely a lovely story to wrap up a little bit of talking on the book. And now I'm sure our listeners would love to know a bit more about you as an author and what kind of roused you up in history, what's been highlights, what's been the highs and lows of your career. What I want to start with is my favorite question on this podcast, which is if you could bust any history myth, what would it be? It doesn't have to be a smart one. You can go somewhere else, but is there anything that you can't
what riles
like,
you?
To me, it's always been the Blitz myth.
Yeah.
The Blitz spirit in London. What is your myth that you just go, bollocks, stop that?
Oh, so there's two of them, which I've mentioned them both, but I'll take this opportunity to reiterate them. Obviously, the Spartan super warrior myth is one, but I want to reiterate it because it's been so destructive, is this East versus West thing. If I could eliminate the discussion of the West from historical discourse, it's just not healthy and not helpful. You know, the system of numbers we write is Arabic in this country. You know, the amount of daylight between the Islam and the Christian faith. And I say this as an intelligence officer, a former intelligence officer who worked counterterrorism missions in Iraq. I have read the Quran and the Al-Bukhari and Al-Qudsi hadith. Like I know Islam. There's just almost no daylight between it and the Christian and Jewish faith. I myself, born Jewish. So this East versus West narrative, which I really think is born in Herodotus, it's just so destructive. And if I could just get people to drop it, I really think that, and there's a historical impetus too. So much of what I need to do my work in the ancient world, it's in Iran. I need to be able to go to Iran and not get arrested. and look at epigraphy and do research and confer with Persian scholars and the political divide and the cultural divide between us and Persia is just so destructive to that end. That's the one thing if I could change. There is no East, there is no West.
It's just a
world.
It's so important to highlight, and you know, I'm really glad that you have done so today because I think it will get a lot of people thinking.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that. So let's make a bit more of a positive twist and looking at you. You know, just kind of let's lighten our little mood here in a good way, obviously. But what has been, and I love this question as well, because I love hearing what people define as like one of the best moments in your career so far. Because everyone's so individual, what they highlight and what's important to them. I love it.
So I grew up my whole life reading Stephen King. Sort of one of my, and I've read everything he's written, but most of what he's written. And as part of my science fiction and fantasy career, I wound up befriending his son, Joe Hill, who's also an amazing horror writer and science fiction writer. And Joe reached out to me for help with gun and military related lore. So he would be writing a book. He doesn't have a military background. And he asked me if I would assist him sort of providing some feedback. And I got acknowledgements in his books. And that meant the world to me because Joe's work is, it's heroic to me. And then Stephen King started working on a book called Billy Summers, which just came out. And a lot of that book deals with, and I won't spoil it, but with scenes in Fallujah in Iraq. And Joe said, hey, would you be willing to talk to my dad? And I
thought, wow.
You know, of course, you know.
Oh my gosh, wow.
And right, so, and you know, there's the danger, never meet your heroes, but of course, Stephen King is just the nicest, kindest.
I've heard most this. Uh-huh.
He's just a wonderful man.
He's a nice guy.
A wonderful man. And so I got to look at his manuscript. I got to give not just military consultation and law enforcement consultation, but also edits. And he acknowledged me in the book when it came out. And look, it's a small thing. I was happy to do it. But you know, like if you had come up to 12-year-old Mike, you know, who was reading Skeleton King and said, hey man, you're gonna help Stephen King with one of his novels, I would have told you were insane.
Yeah.
Right. So it was
so lovely. That's so great.
Really it's a really nice one.
Very so happy to hear you've had those experiences. That must have been such a little, like a proper little kid, like waking up on Christmas morning moment, like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening and you're doing this. So, it's great.
Yeah.
Absolutely lovely to hear. And you've obviously had a great career so far. And I look forward to your next book that's going to come out. And we'll have
thanks.
To discuss it.
Thank you.
So we'll wrap up then with our little fun round at the end. Don't think too hard into it. I'm just going to ask you four questions. Give your first immediate answer.
Okay.
So, first up, who's your favorite figure in all of history?
Oh, this is so tough. I think it would be the Spartan King Archidamus. And the reason is that he did his duty by Sparta in leading the army, but there's so much evidence of him trying to off-ramp the Archidamian phase of the Peloponnesian War and being like, we don't need to do this. This is a bad idea. It's bad for everybody. We don't need to have this fight. And that combination of attempting to prevent violence and attempting to prevent a war, but then saddling up and doing his duty when it was inevitable. That's always the kind of cop and the kind of war fighter I've wanted to be. So I really love that.
All right, flip that on its head then. Who's your least favorite figure in all of history?
Oh my gosh.
Which is probably a
Jared Butler.
And look, I'm so sorry. This is maybe too easy, but I have to say it's Donald Trump. It's Donald Trump.
That is completely fair enough.
I just want to say, like, you have to remember, my whole life has been government service and the police and the fire service and the military, and so much of that was this reflexive pride and this swelling of my heart every time I saw the American flag and heard the national anthem. And that's changed for me now. Again, I'm committed to working with, 40% of this country supports Donald Trump. So I'm committed to working with those people and trying to find,
finding the balance, as we said
correct,
at the start.
Correct, but I won't lie. Something very precious to me my whole life went away in 2016. Yeah. And that's, I'll carry that. That's tough.
Yeah,
I think it's definitely been a strange 5 years for people.
Yeah.
For sure. So if you were to go on a road trip with any three people from history, dead or alive, who would you have in your car?
Okay, so now's where British listeners, your British listeners are going to kill me. So Arthur Hasselrig, Sir William Waller, and probably Sir Ralph Hopton. So these are two parliamentarians and a royalist from your English Civil War in 1640. Hasselrig is the commander of the London Lobsters, which is probably the last armored regiment in history. Well, there still is a Hazel Rigg at Knowsley in Leicestershire, who's a baronet, which I think is just like great-great-grandson who's still kicking around. I have so many questions because I've been really looking into the lives of these men as part of a future project I hope to do. The 17th century knights with guns and knights in armor and guns sharing a battlefield is... and it's also underserved. The reality of it is you go into any Barnes & Noble or Waterston's even in the United States or Britain, you're going to find basically no books in popular books on the English Civil War. Nobody cares. And even British people. And that is not okay.
Quite true.
Because it's fascinating stuff. And I do want to fix it. So I have so many questions for those three men. And one thing I do want to point out to your British listeners, Sir Ralph Hopton and Sir William Waller were on opposite sides. Sir Ralph Hopton, of course, being a royalist, and Sir William Waller being a parliamentarian. And they were dear friends who had fought together in the 30 Years' War. And there is a very moving exchange of letters between Ralph Hopton and Sir William Waller, which I encourage you folks to Google and read, where Sir William Waller is basically saying to him, look, I love you, but duty has us on opposite sides and we will do our duty. And it's an incredibly moving, one of the great pieces of war writing ever written. And I really hope folks will look it up.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, I mean, I think you've actually compelled me to do more research into the English Civil War.
Yeah, because, I think we need to get some episodes going, Phoebe. We need to get some.
I didn't get
You have a huge community.
I didn't get taught at all. Ben, I think we touched upon it at university as we were going through the early modern period, but it wasn't really...
You have a huge reenactment community over there called the Sealed Knot. And if you, I'm sure if you reach out to them, you will find lots of people interested in talking to you.
Oh, hell yeah.
There we go, Phoebe.
Well, for sure.
It's a future podcast there.
So final question I'll ask you then. If you could go back in time just for one day, where and when would you go?
Oh man, oh boy. It's gonna be Thermopylae. And it's gonna be Thermopylae on that day in 480 BC for a couple of reasons. I've already made my theory on what I think happened in the Bronze Lie, but I don't wanna make any promises because publishing is uncertain and I don't know if I'll be able to sell it. But Dr. Michael Livingston, who is someone else you must have on the podcast, well, I won't tell you what to do, I'm sorry. He's a wonderful, and dynamic speaker and an incredible author and a mentor to me. His last book, The Never Greater Slaughter, talks about the Battle of Brunanburh, which basically created England. It's a short book. He's one of the great narrative historians. I just love him so much. He and I are hoping to co-author a book on Thermopylae where we really dive deep, not just on the battle in 480 BC, but all of the battles, because many battles have been fought there. And I can't promise the project will sell. But in order to truly understand what happened on that day, I would need to stand on top of Calidromos with a good view of the pass and check my theory. So it would have to be Thermopylae.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah, I would expect nothing less. I think ancient battles are quite a common one on this show because, like we said in the episode, we've got such kind of limited sources in some sense, like the ancient world, that quite often when we ask this question, people say, I want to go into the ancient world just to see what it was actually like.
Oh,
I don't know.
Have the reality. I've said that, walking through ancient Rome, the dream.
Right. Yes, yes.
It would be a dream.
Oh, amazing. Well, it's been absolutely amazing speech, you might.
Yes, it's so interesting. Lovely, and passionate.
Yeah.
I like it. Yeah, I mean, I like this stuff a lot. Well, thank you. And I appreciate the great questions and the chance to talk to your listeners. I really love this stuff. So thank you so much.
Oh gosh, thank you.
And that was the brilliant Mike Cole talking to us about his new book, The Bronze Lie. Next week we'll be back for another episode, but until next time, this has been Phoebe Style and Olivia Smith, and this is Khaki Malarkey signing off.